Good afternoon and welcome to the second in our series of Francis Bacon Lunchtime Lectures. Just before we begin, can I just ask that you make sure all your mobile phones are turned off? And also to remind you that when asking questions at the end, can you please wait for the microphone to get to you? This is for our recording. Okay, thanks. It's with great pleasure that I introduce our speaker today, Dr. Hugh Davies. As well as being the director of the Museum of Contemporary Art in San Diego, Dr. Davies curated the 1999 landmark exhibition Francis Bacon, The Papal Portraits of 1953. In addition to this, he also interviewed Bacon at his recent new studio in 1973. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Dr. Hugh Davies to the stage.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I'm very grateful to the Tate for inviting me to lecture, and I want to congratulate the curators, Christopher Stevens and Matthew Gale, on this marvelous exhibition that's next door. I also want to thank the Bacon Estate and Brian Clark and Liz Beatty for sponsoring my current visit to London. Thank you, Liz. And also to mention that I'm a member of the Bacon Authentication Committee, which has been a great pleasure over the last few years, and I look forward to serving on that committee for many more years to come. These rather bizarre Polaroids were taken in April of 1973, and I'm ashamed to have to tell you that this is me on the right as a young man with long hair in London some 35 years ago. And on the left, of course, is Francis Bacon. Bacon had recently been given a new Polaroid camera and wanted to try it out one of the days when I was interviewing him. So I sat on the right here in his typical cane chair that you'll see in a lot of the paintings. And I would point out to you in the background, this is actually a mirror, and you can see the cracks in the mirror and the what do you call these things, the heating coil there. And then Bacon, in fact, is sitting on his bed, sort of settling into the eiderdown. And I wanted to note the way this pose is very characteristic, with his forearms sort of exposed, and this lock of hair becomes a signature in many of his paintings. During my year in London from October of 72 through August of 73, I had six formal interviews with Bacon, all of which took place in his Rees Mews studio, and then had many lunches and dinners where he very generously introduced me to people such as Lucian Freud and Sonia Orwell. William Burroughs came and visited while I was over here. Valerie Beston, and most of all, David Sylvester, who later employed me to transcribe his interviews with Bacon, which are one of the great source documents for contemporary art history. And I was sort of the warm-up act. I would interview Bacon on a Tuesday, and then he would come in and do his real interview a couple of days later. Sort of like being a warm-up band for the Rolling Stones or something else. Because we're at the Tate, I have to tell you this one very brief anecdote which sort of shaped my early training as an art historian. But the year that I was here, I was an external student at the Courtauld, and Alan Boness, who was the former director of the Tate, was then teaching at the Courtauld, and he taught a seminar on modern British painting. And at the first meeting of the seminar, he, I think, was impressed that I knew perhaps more about English painting than some of the English students who were in the class, because I've been working on my dissertation on Bacon. And he had just curated a show for the Whitechapel called British Art Decade 40s, and asked me if I would like to accompany him down to the Whitechapel to walk through the show, because he's being interviewed by the BBC. And I, of course, as the new student, leapt this opportunity to be with this famous mentor. And as he was waiting to be interviewed, we wandered around the galleries and looked at the exhibition, including this work by Barbara Hepworth from 1948, called Fenestration of the Ear. It's one of a series of paintings and drawings she did of operations. And he asked me my opinion of Barbara Hepworth. And I said, hoping I would impress him, that I rather thought that Barbara Hepworth had ridden to fame on Henry Moore's coattails, whereupon he informed me that it would be hard for him to be as objective as I was, since Barbara Hepworth was his mother-in-law. I sank through the floorboards and tried to collect myself. This is an out-of-focus image that I took in his living room / bedroom in June of 1973, June 5th, in fact. And I wanted to point out to you that his dress is very characteristic of that time. You'll see it showing up in his self-portraits, this sort of black mock turtleneck. He always pushes his sleeves up. He's very proud of his forearms. An expensive watch. But you'll also see his bedside table here with a reading lamp and all the piled up literature. This is the chair that I was sitting in, and that's the mirror that had the reflection behind me in the radiator, the word I was groping for. And then here are very personal photographs, two of them of George Dyer, who's really the subject of this talk. And they're very similar images, but slightly different, which I think, again, tells you something about Bacon. And this is a life mask of William Blake. And here, I believe this is an image of Peter Lacy, who was another one of Bacon's boyfriends. But I very artfully tried to get Bacon full face and also in profile off the mirror. But this is what he does quite often in his paintings. And then I would point out this naked light bulb hanging from the ceiling, which again appears in many of the paintings. On the left is a photograph I took in his studio on the same day. And you can see what a mess it is. I mean, there are images of his studio have been shown quite extensively. But I juxtapose this with a painting of the same year, self-portrait of 1973, and point out that he's wearing, again, virtually the same clothing, gray slacks here, and then these wonderful boots. He was very proud of these boots. They were canvas and leather. And here you see the gold wristwatch. And the chair, I think you can see it's similar to the chair in the photographs. And this light switch is very similar to the light switches in his home / studio. But I'd also point out that the circular composition, sort of in some ways, there are circles in these other images. It's something that it's a compositional device that Bacon uses over and over again. And this white patch with Letraset press type on it was his approximation of newspaper, just scattered on the floor. And he says that he likes these sort of mundane details of newspaper and light switches and the like. This photograph on the left is not my photograph, but it's from the same time. It shows Bacon sitting in his kitchen / bathroom, very strange room that had a bathtub and a cooker and sink. And a painting again of the same year, 1973, a self-portrait. You can see the same pose, seated at the sink. You can see these canvas boots again, the watch, and then this reflection in the mirror, the naked light bulb. And then in the background of the kitchen, you can see that he would pin up reproductions of his own work, which I always found sort of fascinating. These would be aging on the walls. Bacon's portraits, even from the very beginning, were almost invariably of his friends, people he knew well, that he had spent time with and really understood the contours of their faces. But he would work from photographs, some that he commissioned, some that he found. And these photographs were really cue cards or reminders to sort of trigger his memory in making these images. On the left is a study for Portrait 1 from the Papal Portrait Series of 1953, and on the right is a contemporaneous photograph of David Sylvester, the great critic and art historian who was his friend for more than 50 years. And Bacon has told us that this friend was the source of the original papal image, and I think you can see it to a certain extent. And in a funny way, this almost looks like the beard that later David Sylvester sported throughout his life. Bacon said that If you can't be honest with your friends, who can you be honest with? And this was his response when people accused him of distorting them and deforming their appearance in a way that people felt was aggressive, but he felt was just an attempt to capture their likeness and their personality. And he also said the hardest thing about aging is losing your friends. And in 1973, he told me that most of his friends had died. This photograph, like so many others, is very probably by John Deacon, another great friend of his from the early, even the 40s on, is Lucian Freud, whom you see in the photograph on the left, and then a painting of 1951 showing Freud coming through a door. It appeared to be stairs in the background, but this figure in the doorway is an image that will return to in the black triptychs. But I also like this shadow on the floor and this sort of second shadow. And this is, in some ways, the voyeur, the painter, the viewer, whose shadow indicates our presence in this confrontation with the viewer. I was talking to Martin Harrison the other day about this painting. It really is not a very good painting, but nevertheless, it's Freud. Another great source of his paintings in the portraits in the late 50s and early 60s is Peter Lacy, who was his boyfriend, who died on the eve of Bacon's first retrospective here at the Tate in the early 60s. He drank himself to death in Tangier. And you can see the liberties that Bacon takes in creating this portrait of Lacy, but you can also see sort of the line of the jowls and the sort of strong chin, prominent nose, the recessed hairline. He really captures the likeness, even though it's done through a form of distortion. On the left is Muriel Belcher, who was the owner and held court at the Colony Room where Bacon was a member, along with many other artists like Frank Auerbach, and poets, writers would come and drink at this club. And this is Bacon's 1959 portrait on the right. The photograph on the left is from 1964 by John Deacon. Bacon captures her very strong profile, the sort of receding hairline. She really had a sort of almost bird of prey-like quality. She'd perch on a stool at the end of the bar and sort of hold court. And the first time Bacon took me to the Colony Club and introduced me to her, he said, "This is Hugh Davies, who's doing a piece on my work." And she snapped back and said, "Oh, I bet she's doing some work on your piece," which was a rather rude introduction to London society. This comparison is again a John Deacon photograph commissioned by Bacon of Henrietta Moraes, another one of his subjects. And these photographs, as you can see, she was nude, she was on an unmade bed. They're very sort of casual, unposed, unusual studies. And this great portrait head of Henrietta Moraes, I think, is one of his best pictures. It's one that he gave to his sister, which I think indicates what high regard he held this. And I asked him whether these sort of tusk-like protuberances sort of referred to the predatory nature of women. And he was somewhat offended by that. And he said, no, it didn't at all. But that he thought it captured some of the spirit, the almost animal spirit of Henrietta Moraes, who was a very voluptuous, sensuous creature. This is an image, a photograph of three strips taken from a photo booth. These were taken in Aix-en-Provence in 1966. On the left is Bacon, in the center is George Dyer, and on the right is a man named David Plant. These were found in, this image was found in Bacon's studio as part of the almost archaeological process that cataloged the contents of the studio after Bacon's death, before it was moved to the Hugh Lane Gallery in Dublin, and it has been an absolute treasure trove of sources for Bacon's work. And the person who's really led this work is Martin Harrison. I think Martin is here, if he wasn't feeling too ill to be able to be here. But Martin Harrison has written two books now, one called In Camera, and a newly published book called Incunabula. And these two works really are the best scholarship on Bacon of the last 30 years. Harrison has been incredibly diligent at tracking down these sources and then pairing them with Bacon paintings in a way that really elucidates his method more than any we've seen. So I'm happy to credit Martin and to show many of my comparisons are from his book, in fact. This painting from 1967, you can see, is very similar to the strip photographs, bless you, the previous year. I would point out the way he's cropped the image on the left and the way the shoulder repeats. It's almost like a filmic image dropping in. And Bacon often talks about images dropping in to his consciousness, almost like slides, that then trigger the images he paints. This is a photograph taken in Soho in the early 60s. On the left is John Deacon. Excuse me, taken by John Deacon. On the left is George Dyer. And on the right is Bacon. And this is early in their relationship, when things obviously were very happy. And you can see this reflection of Bacon on the glass. And this sort of the shape of this pane of glass and the composition, again, reminds me of Bacon's own work. And I don't think this is literally a source for one of his paintings, but I think it has very much the feel of some of the paintings that come later. And I asked Bacon about his use of mirrors, and he quoted Cocteau to me. He said, quoting Cocteau, "Each day in the mirror, I watch death at work," which is part of his sort of macabre philosophy. And he also said at the time that he would love to have a room filled with funhouse mirrors, distorting mirrors, that someone could walk through, and that every now and then there would be a regular undistorted mirror, and then we would be shocked to see our normal reflection after becoming habituated to distortion. And I think that, again, sort of reveals something about the way Bacon saw the world. This is a great source photograph for Bacon's paintings, this handsome profile of George Dyer. This shows up time and again in paintings of the 60s and 70s. And Bacon even cut out this template of the silhouette of George Dyer. And you can see here in a painting, one of the smaller head studies, 14 by 12 inch head studies of George Dyer. This one entitled Study for Head of George Dyer of 1967, how he has taken this profile as a starting point of the painting. But what's interesting, to me at least, is the changes that Bacon has made. If you look at the ear here, it becomes this sort of crumpled piece of flesh. This line above the mouth is added and invented. The shadow of the chin gets this sort of red added to it. The eye is closed and no longer in shadow. And then above all, the way the back of the head is just eroded away. It's not necessary to paint it. There's enough shown in the painting as is. And this again is one of these great Harrison comparisons, Martin Harrison. This, I think, is probably the most useful comparison in Harrison's book, In Camera, between a photograph on the left by John Deacon of George Dyer sitting in Bacon's studio. You recognize this mess in the background. And then here is the back of a canvas and a stretcher leaning against the wall. And it's a multiple exposure of George Dyer just sitting in his underwear. But what happens in the multiple exposure is that the leg sort of disappears here. And you see different positions of both the head and the hands, very much as you do in this study of George Dyer of 1971. The photograph is of 65, the painting is of 6 years later, 71.
but you can see the similarities. And again, this ubiquitous cane chair. And the canvas here is replaced with this mirror that reflects what appears to be a chest and an arm, or it might be a leg and then a distorted calf and heel. And again, the back of the chair is reflected in this mirror here. And this circular construction of space and the newspaper under the feet. But the way this thigh projects out like a ham hock into the space, and the way sinew and bone and chair leg are all intermixed, is very much part of Bacon's technique. Bacon's portraits, he tried to go beyond a still appearance or sort of image. He wanted to get almost characteristic gestures of people. And there are paintings of Lucian Freud where he really captures that, the way Freud would turn his head. It's unlike Muybridge's photos of motion, which are successive depictions of steps in motion. They're more like Marais, where there's blurred motion. But it's really this multiple exposure image of Deacon that most closely approximates Bacon's depiction of motion. And this figure of 71 very much anticipates the black triptychs as George Dyer appears in those. This is another one of the small triptych head studies. In these studies, which are 14 by 12 inches, the heads are almost the identical size to the heads in the larger paintings. The scale doesn't change between them. And it's fascinating to study them to understand Bacon's technique, since he's honing in on the face, which is obviously the most important aspect of the portrait. And I asked him, how do you pick the subjects for your portraits? And he said, and I quote, "Only people I know very well, so I know the contours, the formation of the face well. I used to have a friend who was a professional photographer," this is John Deacon, "take pictures of them, straightforward pictures, nothing out of the ordinary. Then he went on to say that the portraits are, quote, memory traces of them, of the subjects, and that he used the photographs and his memory to paint from. The photos were used like cue cards to recall, to trigger, to evoke the expressions and the postures, but they were always characteristic of the subject that he wished to portray." And then in explaining the distortion in these portraits, he said, "I think if you want to convey fact, this can only ever be done through a form of distortion. You must distort to transform what is called appearance into image." And that was always his goal, was to go beyond the simple likeness and create an image that was more factual on the one hand, directly from the nervous system, and also captured something universal rather than just one person's face. Here you see the sort of very characteristic format of profile facing to the right, full face in the center, and then on the left, facing to the left. And this is three studies of George Dyer, some of the most distorted images. This is from 1969, and you see this almost bullet hole-like form at the center of each of these paintings. And this is made by just taking a paint cap and twisting it on the wet paint on the surface. And this background, this pink background, is very characteristic of that same period. Now, Bacon could be just as severe with his own image. This is a self-portrait, a characteristic sort of jowly cheek, the hair, the receding hairline, and this sort of jacket that he wore a lot. And I'm not sure who these other subjects are. They may be self-portraits, they may be Dyer, they may be someone like Peter Beard. Another quote that Bacon liked to use, I think it applies to this image, is that from Michel Lyris, the French poet and writer, that all flesh is eroded by its future absence, which I think is, again, his sense of memento mori. And he spoke about the irrational likeness. Quote, "One thing could be said to hold true for all my life, that I seek an irrational likeness, to take the irrational further. The mystery lies in the irrationality by which you make appearance. If it is not irrational, then you make illustration." And he was very dismissive of narrative painting or illustration. Now, this is one of the great triptychs of, it's entitled Triptych in Memory of George Dyer of 1971. And this was really the first of the series of works that are referred to as the Black Triptychs. And these triptychs were painted in the year following George Dyer's death. George Dyer committed suicide 2 days before the opening of Bacon's major retrospective at the Grand Palais in Paris in 1971. And obviously this came as a tremendous loss to Bacon, and I think there was a certain amount of guilt on his part that being preoccupied with the show or whatever, that he had really let his friend down. So what you see in this triptych is quite simply, on the left, these two figures wrestling, and they have wrestling boots on and shorts. And they're not wrestling on a traditional mat on the floor. They're sort of perched on this railing that extends behind the center panel and continues in the right-hand panel. And it's somewhat precarious, as if they fall, they would be in peril. And then on the right is this portrait, again, the silhouette of George Dyer, as if it's on a canvas leaning against the wall. And then this sort of strange reflection, but that has been flipped and reversed. It's not the mirror image, it's been twisted. And it shows up on the top of this table, almost as if the table had a mirrored surface. And Bacon is known in his days as an interior designer to have made tables that had mirrored surfaces. The center panel is more anecdotal. This very simple, mundane gesture of a man from the back reaching to turn a key in a lock. And you see the naked light bulb, but the space is somewhat distorted, almost an expressionist distortion, like the film Dr. Caligari's Cabinet. And I think that this image of the figure turning the key probably relates to Bacon's hearing George Dyer come in late at night and sort of wondering where he's been. Not on the night that he died, because Bacon wasn't there, but on other nights, sort of worried about George wandering around. So on the left, you have this metaphor of the struggle of this man who decides to commit suicide. In the center, you have this sort of anecdote. On the right, you have this memorial portrait, and that's the format that that Bacon uses later in this series. This is on June 5th, when I took these photographs of Bacon in his studio, I asked him if he would just do this gesture of locking the door, never thinking one day I'd be looking at the Tate and be able to juxtapose it with this picture from the center panel on the triptych. But I think you can see that the arm is not unlike his. He may have used his own arm as the model for painting this. But the fact that it's just the arm and sort of part of the back and shoulder, and the rest of the figure is in darkness, sort of in shadow or just wasted away, is very significant. And when I asked Bacon why he painted this figure, this mundane gesture of opening the door, he said, well, there are two things. One, I like an image of someone doing a simple action, like switching on a light or turning a key. And secondly, and then he walked away and I couldn't hear. I was in the studio and he walked into the living room and he came back with a well-worn copy of Eliot's The Wasteland. And then he read, I've heard the key turn in the door once and turn once only. And he went on to say that The Wasteland had been a continual inspiration to him. Now, this is the first of the black triptychs, and this painting, as well as one other that I'll show you later, are hanging together in a great room called the Memorial Room, room number 8 in the current exhibition. And it's very moving to go into that space and see these three triptychs, the one I've just shown you before, this one. This is on the left, and on the right is the last of the black triptychs. As I explained, Bacon was coming to terms with the death of his friend and the fact that he had committed suicide. In fact, Dyer took an overdose of pills and drank, and Bacon came back from this dinner 2 days before the opening of the show and discovered him dead, seated on the toilet that was in a bathroom that adjoined their two rooms. They had individual rooms on either side of it, a shared bathroom. And that's significant later when I show you the sort of geography of the paintings. From the very beginning, Bacon maintained the fiction that Dyer had died of a coronary, and some people were upset by this, but he told me that he did this to protect Dyer's parents. He didn't want them to think that their son had committed suicide. What you see here is the three times he will use this setting of figures centered in front of doorways. In this case, the doorways are black, as if the void is beyond them. And you have this sort of proscenium-like stage thrust forward with the diagonals on the right and the left. And in the center, these two wrestling figures, now no longer with wrestling boots and with their clothes on, are wrestling naked, and they're right on the edge of the abyss, as if this, at any moment, this struggle will resolve in either life or death. The figure on the left is of George Dyer, this posthumous portrait. And this was painted in the fall of 1972. And you can see that he has a very classic, almost like a Roman bust, sculptural treatment of the head and shoulders, but this red closed eye, as if posthumous. And then this very faint white line that sort of cuts off the top of the body from the lower half. And then this is very much like the painting I showed you earlier of Dyer in his undershorts seated on the cane chair. But here you can see his leg is really pulled out and distended, and there is this sort of pink shadow as if life is draining out of him, sort of pouring out of the figure onto the floor. And this photograph, again found in the studio of George Dyer with his eyes closed, I think is probably the source that Bacon was working from. Here you can see the ear is copied almost directly, but the lower half of the face has been really dramatically changed. The source for some of this distortion and elongation of the figure is undoubtedly from this painting by Sickert, which Bacon owned. He had this in his studio, which is why the photograph is not so good. I apologize, this is another one of my photographs. But it was the only artwork that he had in his home during the time that I was visiting in 72, 73. And this figure, seated figure in the background here, it's very hard to see in the slide, but the way Sickert has painted it is in very summary fashion, sort of just drawing the trouser leg into the ankle, into the foot, not unlike the way Bacon is painting. And he admired Sickert. Rebecca Daniels, who's doing her dissertation on Sickert, and I were talking about this the other night, but it's very interesting that both Sickert and Bacon draw on photography as a source, and they both drawn on stories in newspapers and magazines. So here you have the full composition again. Dyer on the left, sort of watching his own death struggle, and you see this shadow, this sort of arrow on the edge of the wrestling figures as if they're in motion. And then Bacon on the right with his back turned to Dyer. The central image of the wrestlers is based on a Muybridge photograph. And I think you can see here from this pyramidal arch back of this wrestling figure is quite clearly the source of Bacon's wrestler. Here, the buttocks of this man below is very close to this part of the photograph. But the head has slipped down to here and been very much distorted. And the shadows now become this, again, pink flesh puddle that's coming out of the figures. But by moving the figures from this grid and putting them in front of the abyss, gives it a very different meaning. Bacon painted two figures on a bed based on a wrestling image of Muybridge as early as 1953. This is an extraordinary painting, and I'm sure everyone regrets that it is not in the current exhibition, but Lucian Freud, who owns it, for some reason refuses to lend it to any exhibitions. I have no idea why. But when I was in London in 73, Bacon asked me if there were any paintings that I especially wanted to see that I hadn't seen, and this was the one I mentioned, not knowing that it was owned by Freud. So he took me over to Freud's studio, sort of home studio, and it was in a very small room with a single bed opposite it, maybe 6 feet back from the painting. And the three of us sat there on this little bed and stared at this painting for a long time, and it was an amazing experience to have these two great painters looking at this painting. And I've always wondered, I don't know if Freud is bisexual or whatever, whether it might have been the two of them. But very daring thing to paint the act of two men making love in 1953, when this was an illegal act in this country. And you can see the grimace on this face below, the sort of animalistic quality of these two men sort of ferociously going at it. I always think of Courbet's image of the two women on a bed, which is sort of after they've made love and they're sort of in repose. And this is that tension, that sort of animal tension, of this sort of almost predatory action of the figure above. But the way the bed is painted, it's just incredibly beautiful. And these figures are sort of coaxed into being with very little paint. Again, this example of not wanting to paint with slavish detail, but just capture the spirit of the moment and the sense of motion and the turmoil. And this very characteristic cage, just to define space, not to create claustrophobia. And then the headboard, which is very much like the bed he had in his studio, and this sort of veiled curtain behind, very typical of 52, but look how closely he has followed the source for the upper figure, and then the lower figure is entirely different, but probably based on another Muybridge study. So the first instance of the two wrestlers being depicted on a bed is in this triptych, Studies for the Human Body of 1970. And flanking on the left and the right of these two figures on this round sort of bed, sort of like almost like a big bench that's been upholstered. And here this curved railing again in the circular format. On the right and left are these two pendant panels. And here is a camera, a movie camera, almost like a prehistoric creature with these eyes and horns. And this is a portrait of Bacon. So Bacon is depicting himself as if he's filming this, almost like a porn movie or something, from behind this doorway, naked light bulb above, doorknob to the side. And this very strange, abstracted form. And here the newspaper with the press type on it. And then on the left, I don't know, but I think this might be a portrait of Dyer. This was a contemporaneous image of Dyer from one of the, it's the center panel of one of the portrait triptychs of 1963. And I think you can see this head and the way it's divided is similar in the hairline, that sort of thing. But it's not really that significant. What is significant, I think, is the way the press type is done here. And I, being a young, eager art historian, read this as B-R-A-C, Braque, as if it were referring to Braque's use of collage in cubism. And then I saw this as Monroe, so I started thinking it was Marilyn Monroe in movies, and maybe it was a Zapruder film, that sort of thing. And so I asked Bacon about this collage, and he said that he had deliberately not used actual newspaper because he didn't want it to be that literal, and he wanted it to last. And that, quote, "I avoided real paper or spelling things out so that people wouldn't read in meaning," which was a real young man, don't read in meaning. But he really liked the ambiguity of this figure. He would bring out his catalog from the show at the Grand Palais and turn to this page and specifically point out this figure. And what he liked about it is, as he said, you know, they could be two people embracing, but it could also be a bird of prey, as if alighting, coming down. It has a strange arm to the side here, another protuberance here, this sort of mono leg and the shadow and then sort of obscured face. And he also pointed out that these people who are reflected in the side panels could very well be in our space, which I thought was interesting that he would suggest it was from beyond the space of the canvas, very much like Velázquez is depicting himself in the Las Meninas. And when I pointed out this likeness to Bacon, he said he didn't realize it was himself, and he said he saw the face, but he didn't seem pleased, and he said it doesn't look accidental and unconscious, yet it is. And then he went on to say, it was a very instinctive thing to include the camera. I didn't know it was going to be a camera, but it seemed right with the figures on the bed. And then he said, I'm not trying to say anything, as I believe that every movement signifies a meaning. And it was at that point that he indicated these figures on the right and left could be outside the space. Here is another Harrison comparison. And on the left is a self-portrait by Bacon taken with a Polaroid camera. And on the right-hand panel of Triptych, March 1974, where he paints this figure with a camera. And I would point out to you the door frame here and this light switch with the sort of the cord going up or against the wall. This is taken off that mirror, a cracked mirror. Again, here's the radiator, the black chest of drawers. And you can see how the frame of this painting probably indicates that this was a direct source. Bacon paints the things around him. The final and right-hand frame is very unusual in Bacon's work in that he faces away from the center. He's facing, he's turned his back on Dyer. It's almost as if during this great struggle, he has abandoned his friend. And one of the most extraordinary passages of painting, whereby his chest and arm are almost fully rendered on one side and then completely vacant on the other side. It's almost as if this is skin being flayed and removed. And his own limbs, like George Dyer's, are distended into this pink puddle of flesh, which always makes me think of the life draining out of these figures. And like the Shakespearean quote, oh, that this tutu solid flesh would melt. And here this is almost a literal depiction. But he has this downward glance, a real sense of sadness in this self-portrait. His eyes are closed, as most of the eyes are in these black triptychs. Very, very profound image of loss. And again, that quote of Michel Liris, all flesh is eroded by its future absence, sort of memento mori for Bacon as well. I'd also point out just a detail that you see the edge of this door jamb and the edge of this door jamb as if the viewer's vantage point is to the right of these three images. The second triptych in this series, entitled Three Portraits Triptych, posthumous portrait of George Dyer on the left, self-portrait in the center, and portrait of Lucian Freud on the right of 1973, is really the second black triptych. It is the sort of the calm at the center of the storm, and it's a sort of taking stock, Bacon taking stock of life in the winter of 1972-73. And so in painting, he uses the same format, the three doorways, but in this case, each one has a naked light bulb in the background, and the background is this sort of light blue. It's not as threatening or ominous as the black doorways. And they're in a sort of domestic setting, and this is actually an Aubuchon carpet that he created. And I think it's hard to see in this image, but in the actual painting, it's really an incredible passage of painting. It reminds me sort of Monet water lilies or things like that, which again shows that Bacon had this incredible facility to paint well beyond the figure. But the image of George Dyer is now almost like a carved totem, very severely sculpted in this strange socket around this lifeless eye, sort of red as if in death. the black shadow returns, and he's in this contrapposto twisting pose, almost confronting Bacon with this expression. And then in the background, you see Bacon has painted an illusionistic image of a photograph of himself, Bacon, pinned to the wall. And this, we now know, is based on a photograph that was found in Bacon's studio. And you can see, again, how closely, in making his depiction of it, he is drawn on the photograph. But with all these sources, it's interesting to see the changes he makes. I want to show this because this is my favorite Bacon self-portrait, and it was made in 1969, a couple of years before this triptych. I think this is one of the great likenesses. Again, this characteristic forelock of hair that he was so proud of. He would dye his hair with shoe polish before he went out in the town. This sort of sculpting of the eye sockets, the jowliness of the cheek and chin, and then he had very kind of fleshy, rubbery lips, and that often it's the mouth that has the most sort of migration going on in these portraits, and this jacket, which he liked, with a sort of leather collar. But just think it's a fantastic portrait, and here using the paint caps again to show the sort of cleft chin. But the center image in this portrait is a self-portrait, and in this case, Bacon is facing forward, facing the viewer, and his arm is up as if shielding this accusatory gaze of George Dyer coming from the left, his right. And there's this sort of excrescence here. In my working notes, I used to call it a snot bubble, but I don't think that's an art historical term. But this sort of wards off Lucian Freud on the right. And again, his face is quite red, and these eyes almost look as though he's been weeping. And the way he grasps the chair, sort of holding on, is, I think, quite telling. And then finally, on the right-hand side, the image of Lucian Freud, his great friend at the time, has lost his partner, his lover, still has his great painter friend. And this is actually the second version of this panel. The first one was not going well, and Bacon came home drunk and destroyed it, and then remade this version, which he liked much better. And what he liked about it is, again, this sort of contrapposto, as if he caught this gesture of Freud turning, a characteristic gesture, so it could go beyond just a static image. And here you see he paints an arrow on the shoulder, sort of indicating that the shoulders are turning. And the face has this blurred quality, but it has the sort of bird-like intensity and of Freud's face. I'm not sure who this is. I've always thought it was Freud, but it may be Dyer, it might be Bacon. But again, it's this wonderful sort of play of an illusionistic depiction of a photograph pinned to the wall. The final black triptych, and the last work that we will consider today, is Triptych May-June 1973. And by February, I came to London in October of 72, and in order to do a dissertation, I had to interview Bacon. There wasn't enough published on him to justify a dissertation at my university without first-hand source material. And I waited at the Marlborough Gallery for days. They were kind enough to let me use their library to do research, and I was reading reviews and rereading Ronald Alley's great catalog of the 1962 exhibition and reading whatever I could get my hands on, waiting for Bacon to come in so that I could then go and accost him. And finally, in early February, he came in to get a check or something like that, and I had to deal with the receptionist. I was on the fifth floor. She called me. I ran down, confronted him in the stairwell, and said, "You know, I'm Hugh Davies. I've come from America. I'm trying to do a dissertation." And he couldn't have been nicer. He was very polite. He said, "Oh, how can I help you?" And then agreed to do these interviews. So over the next 6 months, I had the opportunity to not only interview him, but to see this painting and others being made in successive stages. But this is sort of the very down-to-brass-tacks factual statement of what occurred that fateful night in Paris in 1971, and George Dyer had been left in the Hotel Saint-Pierre, and he, from the evidence presumably found, he vomits in the sink, crosses the room, and then seats himself on the toilet and dies there. What Bacon has done to sort of obscure the narrative or askew the chronology is to reverse the sequence so that the right-hand panel, the vomiting, chronologically would probably move this way. We do know that the left-hand panel is the final state that George Dyer was found in. So starting with the right-hand panel, this, again, is a really troubling image of this figure, this line on the shoulder that goes across the back that sort of continues into the plumbing. It's almost, you know, you can feel the life going down the drain, as, and you can feel the kind of spasms this body is racked by as this man vomits into the sink, and you can see flecks of red as if it's blood or his tongue, and then his eye closed, and then this impetuous gesture of taking a glob of white paint. This is a three-dimensional glob that you can see on the surface of these paintings that Bacon literally takes in his hand or on the end of a brush and throws it at the canvas so it splats and then has a trail that goes down, again, emphasizing the force and direction of this figure. And here you can see that the same format of the three doorways, but here, in every case, the figure has passed beyond and is functioning in the black, in the abyss. The struggle has been lost between life and death. The center panel is this sort of blurred depiction of motion, the only one that has the light bulb, and it casts this bat-like shadow, sort of a memento mori. It's almost like an anamorphic form, like Holbein's The Ambassadors with the skull that's in the foreground. And you can see how eroded this body is, and this sort of intent expression of Dyer just wanting to get where he can sit down, having gone through this fierce vomiting sequence. When I first saw this painting, Bacon said that he regretted the sensational nature of the painting, but that he had to paint it since he was obsessed with it and he had to get it out of his system. And at the time I asked him if that white smear was becoming his signature. He'd used it on a number of paintings in that year. And he said no, he didn't always use it. He also said that he'd done this center panel, but he didn't want to show it to me because he wasn't sure if it was finished, and he didn't know if he would keep it. And he also said that he didn't know whether he would keep this painting or whether he would sell it. I think he knew even then that he'd made something pretty extraordinary. And the fact that it helped him get beyond the death of this great friend sort of attests to its importance in his work. So the final image is this pathetic image of the sort of fetal positioned figure with crossed legs seated on the toilet. The white of the body is almost like the white of the porcelain, and the curves of the toilet are like the curves of the body. And then again, this smear of white paint. It's almost like the bone has been pulled out of the body. You see the underside of the foot here. And the door frames in this painting are quite distorted, again, like the center panel of the first allegorical black triptych. But the most troubling thing is this black wash that has seeped into the canvas, the unprimed canvas, as if death is just coming over the figure. And Bacon has used the image of the crouching figure frequently in his work. This is a great painting, again, that's upstairs in the galleries, that is of a crouching figure, one of the first and most successful crouching figures of 1952, Study for Crouching Nude. And here the nude is on a railing. Again, this circular format, this wonderful yellow that Bacon's painted at the base here. And in the background, you see these numbers, and you can see in its source from this jumping figure in Muybridge, in all Muybridge's photographs, there were these numbers so that artists could measure how far along in the grid so that when they were painting, they could copy the grid. Bacon also made a triptych in 1964, which incorporated a figure on a toilet. This is triptych, three figures in a room of 64. This was just after he and Dyer were spending time together. And it's very likely this is Dyer painted from the back. And again, this sort of melding of man and latrine. But what an odd harbinger of what was to occur some 7 years later. This is, I think, one of the great paintings of George Dyer of 1966, Portrait of George Dyer Crouching. And Bacon has him on a coffee table as if it's a diving board, and he looks like a gargoyle with these protuberances coming out of his head. And then the setting is, again, this rounded setting, but here it's a couch. And I asked Bacon about the couch and if it had originally just been a railing, and he said, yes, the couch was a circular structure that I filled in later. I tend to turn furniture and twist it about as much as the bodies for my own ends. This crouching image of George Dyer anticipates that final black triptych. It also has this egg as if he's a chicken who's laid an egg, and then this pile of clothes on the side. I'll just very quickly take you back to this figure here, also has the pile of clothes in the circle, and then this shadow as if it's another figure that's occurring here from this crouching figure. But Bacon's source for this work, I think, is quite clearly from this famous work of Degas called Le Tub, of this figure apparently unobserved, unabashedly pursuing her toilette. And if you look at her hand here, the way this hand is down here, and so the crouching figure, the circular setting, and the way the circle is cropped, the clothing here, I think these are more than coincidental. But returning to this final image, Bacon, at a later stage, first time I saw this panel, it did not have this arrow. It was added later. And Bacon claimed that he added these arrows to sort of objectify the scene, to make it more like a crime scene, and to counter the sensationalism of what was happening. And he told me that the source was from a book on golf instruction. And this is, I just went to any book that had arrows, and this is an image of Jack Nicklaus blasting out of the pines. But I've since learned from reading Martin Harrison's Incunabula that there is a book from 1951 by Louis T. Stanley and called Style Analysis that is surrounded with arrows. So in future lectures, I will use that image rather than this one. And this is an image I took that same day, June 5th, of Bacon in the studio. And you see the arrow has been added by now. Here are the canvases stacked up on the side. And you can see his technique for drawing in the door frames and charcoal. And again, his watch. But I think the expression here tells you a lot, that this is a painful painting for Bacon, a very painful moment in his life. And I'll just end with this final detail that I took, where you can really see the black wash. And I want to read you one final quote from Bacon, and it's a long verbatim quote, so bear with me. I wanted to give you the sense of how he spoke. Expressionism is the will to convey an idea. My work is to express how facts work, fall on me, to coagulate facts which make images of reality. I'm always trying to coagulate fact and image, to go further, to say, to assemble facts and make images, because in trying to paint a portrait, I would like it to be a likeness. I would like it to be a universal image as well as a specific fact, so that the image worked on the nervous system after the appearance had been diminished. Image is appearance. But in its greatest form, it is a wide concentration of fact, image and fact. Fact is in a way more important than superficial imagery of appearance. I would like to use the appearance and to keep the appearance and out of those facts to conjugate an image. The everyday wash of life washes into one's whole imagery, and that mingled with instinct and chance brings up images. I use the whole of my experience, and I know this all goes into the work, not consciously, but it goes into all the imagery. Thank you. I'm very pleased to take questions. I'm sorry I went on a bit too long, but if anybody has questions, those of you who have to be somewhere, please don't stand on ceremony. I think there's a question back here. Apparently we have
questions.
To use the microphone so that we can hear your question.
You spoke a bit about how two of Bacon's great loves, Peter Lacy and George Dyer, both died days before two major retrospectives of his work. Do you think there's any significance in that? Does it tell you anything about the intensity with which he worked towards his retrospectives, or is that just a coincidence?
Well, it's a very good question, a very good observation. Again, we were chatting about this with the members of the Authentication Committee the other night, and referencing Oscar Wilde, that to lose one parent is unfortunate, to lose both is careless. And it seems to be more than coincidence to me. And I think, as you suggest, that the intensity of working up to a major exhibition, a retrospective, he may have been more beastly and horrible than normal. I mean, tough guy. I mean, he could be really brutal. There are times that we would be in the Colony Club or something like that, and he'd be tearing strips off somebody. And I would have to resist the urge to say, you know, Francis, please, you don't need to do this to this guy. Have another glass of champagne. But he's tough. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if his intensity drove his friends to this state. I mean, twice, perhaps more than coincidence. But it's the way he lived his life. He was very intense. He did not suffer fools lightly. Everything was pushed to the limit. And he obviously pushed these friends beyond the limit. And as I was saying earlier, he could sort of expiate this. He could paint it out of his system. And they didn't have a way to do that. I mean, they tried through drugs or alcohol, but didn't work for them. So I tend to think that you're right. Since he's not here to contradict me.
I was very interested in the way you were depicting Lucian Freud and Bacon, that they seem to reveal a very raw inner life of the human being. And I just wondered what their opinion was of each other's work, and also just a sense of what Lucian Freud felt about the partnership of Dyer and Freud. Dyer and Bacon.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part. How he felt about
the relationship between Dyer and Bacon, and whether there was any competitive rivalry there, or whether that was just...
You know, I only spent that one evening with Freud, so I didn't really get a feel for the relationship. But like many of you probably know, that Freud and Bacon had a great falling out at some point, I think later in the 70s or the early 80s. But in 73, they were still quite cordial and close. I believe they shared a studio earlier in the 50s and sort of worked side by side. My sense is that Freud's painting got a lot better after 92 when Bacon died. And I think it's almost an Oedipal thing that this more senior, famous figure was no longer there to compete with, in a way. But I have no idea how Freud viewed Bacon's relationship with his lovers. I mean, I gather Freud had plenty of lovers of his own, so. I do remember the one night that we drove up to see, we went to see this painting, and then we drove in Lucian Freud's old Bentley down to have dinner at Wheeler's in Soho. And Bacon was sitting in the front with Freud, and I was in the back with the girlfriend of the moment. And there was so much newspaper in the back of this Bentley that you couldn't put your feet down. The entire seat well was filled with papers. We both had our knees up at our chins trying to ride in the back of this car with these two great painters conversing in the front seat. It was a very sort of absurd, surreal way to spend time. But they were very close.
and then had this terrible falling out. And I think ever since the falling out, out of some sort of spite, Freud does not lend the Two Figures painting, which is incredible painting. I hope that answers your question. Any more questions?
Hugh, in your interviews with Bacon, did you ever doubt the veracity of what he was saying to you or his intention?
I doubted it all the time. And I mean, one point, I was always trying to find sources. I didn't have the luxury of going through the stuff in the studio, which would have been incredible. But I would, he was very, because I was young and I'd spent a lot of time learning about him, he would say things like, well, at that time I had my Cromwell studio. And I'd say, no, actually you had moved from that studio at that time. Really? And so he was generous and would lead me along. And he would say things like, well, have you read Aeschylus? You really should read Aeschylus. And I'd read it, and then we'd talk the next time. So he would help me in that way and sort of lead me to sources. And, you know, he'd say, you've got to go look at the Velasquez Venus in the National Gallery. Spend time with that painting, and then the mirror in that painting, and all that sort of stuff. But often in my notes, I would interview him, take notes as he spoke, and I only recorded him once, which was a few years later. But I would, after we had parted company, I would scribble down lots of things. And I would often scribble down, you know, don't believe that, sounds like a line. But I was, you know, I was warming him up for David Sylvester with all these interviews. And he's a very articulate, smart man, extremely well-read, and sort of liked the sound of his own voice, and came up with some real zingers. And I asked him about Jackson Pollock, and he said, oh, it looks like old lace. Which was, I mean, what a put down to the great muscular American painter that looks like old lace. And then Henry Moore, I had done my undergraduate work on Henry Moore's shelter drawings, which amazing drawings. And Bacon said they look like knitting where he's dropped the stitches. So, I mean, these are well practiced lines. So, yes, I did not take everything or anything as the truth. He would also say, I wouldn't have to paint it if I could tell you what it was. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed for coming. I don't know if you've... I hope to see some of you at the next lunchtime lecture, which is Maggie Hambling, and next Thursday and Friday, just to let you know, there's also a 1.5-day conference on Bacon, of which there are still some tickets available. But anyway, thank you very much, Hugh, for coming over.